Welcome back to the program. You know, the state of medicine, healthcare, our relationship to doctors is front and center right now in our national consciousness, and that means that there's no better time to take a look at the unique doctor-patient relationship and to do so with National Book Award-winning author Dr. Sherwin Nuland. His new book, The Soul of Medicine, is a collection of compelling stories culled from his own personal experience, but stories that tell us a great deal about the doctor-patient relationship. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Sherwin Nuland. He's a clinical professor of surgery at Yale University School of Medicine, a fellow at Yale's Institute for Social and Policy Studies, and his new book is The Soul of Medicine, Tales from the Bedside. Dr. Sherwin Nuland, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Great to have you here. Do you think that most patients really understand what the day-to-day life of a doctor is really all about?
Oh, not at all. Doctors tend to be placed, even in this late day, on pedestals. And I think doctors glory in that image. And as a matter of fact, whether they're aware of it, consciously aware of it or not, it affects significantly their relationship with patients.
Do you think that attitude still exists to the same degree today, or has that pedestal been banged up a little bit over the years?
Well, I think the second part of that sentence is the correct one. It has been banged up, but there's something intrinsic in the doctor-patient relationship that ends up, no matter how much it gets banged, as being the masterful person, the one who's really in charge, and the one who is coming to that masterful person for some kind of help that they can't provide on their own. In addition to which, most people who are in middle age right now have been brought up with the old image that hasn't changed, because it has changed only perhaps in the last 15 years.
One of the things that we hear over and over again is that people have to take responsibility for their own health care, for their own health.
Right.
And certainly the internet and all the information that's available today certainly allows them to do that. How has that impacted on a personal level the doctor-patient relationship?
Well, one of the things we've got to bear in mind is that there's a difference between information and knowledge. And further goes on that there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. To get information from the internet about a particular set of symptoms or about a particular disease is an important thing to do, and it's very good to do. But one of the things the doctor is able to do because of his or her education and experience is to incorporate that into a body of knowledge so as to have some sense of judgment about how to proceed with things, whether there needs to be further workup, whether something that is being dealt with is insignificant, and also even about the preventive measures. The preventive measures are easier to understand. They tend to be relatively straightforward. There are plenty of columnists and radio broadcasters, thank goodness, who tell us about them. But when it comes to a real disease, then the matter of knowledge, judgment, wisdom, these things come to the fore, and that's what the doctor can provide.
You know, it relates to an interesting phenomenon, a broader phenomenon taking place in our society, and that is that the lack of respect that has grown over the years for experience and expertise. And certainly
exactly.
It's impacted a lot of other fields, and it's interesting its relationship to medicine.
Oh, it's absolutely true. I had this experience just this weekend. I had been asked to see a friend, not as a patient, but to help that person decide about a group of therapies that were being recommended for a rather serious disease that he had. And when I got to his house, his wife said to me, "Oh, we don't have to discuss this at all anymore, because Susie," I'm making a name
sure.
up, "who had the same disease, came here and told us what we should do." Well, the same disease was cancer, and of course there are so many, 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 many different kinds of cancer. Also, how can Susie integrate the fact that this particular cancer exists with other problems or with other situations in the general matter of health, linking it to that individual patient's experience and lifestyle? These are the places where we are convinced that patients go wrong, assuming that different kinds of particular diseases are so related to one another that you can extrapolate from one to the other.
To what extent does fear play a part in it? You know, most people, when they go to the doctor, there's some element of fear going on. And that certainly impacts this relationship, regardless of all these other sort of more intellectual approaches to it.
Well, this sense of fear is a very important phenomenon to take into consideration in dealing with patients in general, because doctors, of course, become so accustomed to dealing with the worst kinds of illness, the worst kinds of symptoms, that very often they don't recognize a patient who's putting up a good front as really being a patient who is terribly frightened. All the more reason that it's important to go into detail about what one is dealing with each patient, so that they understand the reason for the recommendations of the doctors, they understand the reason that sometimes treatments fail, and they recognize what they have ahead of them and what their hopes should be realistically for an appropriate and rapid or perhaps prolonged recovery period.
But of course, in this day and age, given the realities of medicine, doctors don't always have that amount of time.
That's one of the things we've lost with the great knowledge explosion. Years ago, a doctor could be at leisure to see a patient for 20 minutes or longer and discuss all aspects of a situation, answer any questions that might come up, and the patient would leave with a sense of confidence that this physician not only understands their dilemma, but has empathy for it, can almost put himself or herself in the patient's place. With the explosion of knowledge, there has become also an explosion of technology, so that doctors become so focused on technology, so focused on what can be learned from looking at a computer screen, that they downplay in their own minds the importance of that extra time with patients. And we know what these statistics are. We're down to anywhere between 8 and 12 minutes per patient in the average internist's office, and that's a dreadful situation to be in.
Right. How is this being dealt with in our medical schools today? How are students today being taught, and is it different given these modern realities we've been talking about?
Well, that's a crucial question, Jeff, that you've just asked. Many medical schools, recognizing the problem, have done any of a number of things about it. One of the things that is being done is virtually every school now has a course or an exposure to what we call medical ethics, which has a lot to do with how a doctor relates to the patient and how a doctor can put him or herself in the place of the patient. Ethics is not some separate course, some separate discipline that stands apart from daily medical practice. Ethics involves itself in every transaction between two people when there's a professional situation involved. So they are beginning in the last 2 or 3 years to put ethics directly into the clinical curriculum, the bedside curriculum. Another thing that's helpful, although on the surface of it, its helpfulness is not obvious, is bringing students back to the humanities, English literature, philosophy. There are now such courses in certain medical schools, but perhaps of more importance, students, especially in the first 2 years, are not infrequently exposed to the kinds of liberal arts that they had in college and they seem to think is not important until they recognize that what one reads, not having to do with medicine, largely influences how one behaves in relationship to the people who come to them for help.
And from your own personal experiences, when you deal with students and young doctors, those that have had an education that has in some ways steeped them in the liberal arts and the humanities and the things you're talking about, how are they different or better as doctors?
Well, of course, that's a hard question to answer with specificity, but one certainly gets the sense in making rounds with these young people that the more liberal their education is, the more self-aware they tend to become. less they focus on the science of what they're doing and the more they focus on the humanity of what they're doing. For example, doctors, by the very nature of medical school, of what they've gone through to get where they are, seem to develop a rather outsized need for the emotional rewards, not only of overcoming disease, but also of being healthy and strong, while patients, of course, are diminished by their illnesses. So the effect on medical care of the relationship between power and impotence is an unacknowledged thread that runs through the practice of the what we call the art of medicine. And so is the insatiable appetite for extravagant gratitude and constant burnishing of self-image. When doctors have a more liberal education, they're much more likely to be self-aware of these things in themselves, in their own personalities, and to make allowances for it and try to bring the sick along to the realization that there's a level of equality between two human beings that no sickness can erase.
And in many cases, that was dealt with in the past by the fact that people had long-standing, ongoing relationships with their doctor, so that that power relationship equaled out a little bit more over time.
Oh, you're absolutely right. They not only had long-term relationships, but they got to know their doctors much more as human beings. And doctors tend to make decisions in the background of their own emotions, their own needs, their own insecurities, strengths, strivings, that kind of thing. And when a physician has had a long-range relationship with a patient and he understands the needs of that person as well as perhaps his own needs, he is much more likely to tailor the kind of diagnostic workup, tailor the kind of therapeutic usages that he carries out, because he recognizes the individuality of each patient and the way each patient interacts with him or her emotionally.
The other thing it's impossible to escape from, and even reading so many of these stories in your book, it's hard to not be impacted by the way we view doctors, not only from our own personal experience, but from the way doctors have always been seen in the popular culture. Talk a little about that.
Well, there's no question about that. Hippocrates taught us through how long ago, almost 3,000 years ago now, that, and this is exactly the way it is in the Hippocratic text, he says, doctors who have confidence, patients who have confidence in their doctors are much more likely to do well. And there is a story in my book, In the Soul of Medicine, about a patient who is desperately sick. And the physicians, as good as they were and as scrupulous as they were in the diagnostic workup, weren't able to figure out how to get this man better. And he had so much confidence that he would talk about it, and they were frank with him in admitting that they were at sea with diagnosis, with therapy, and yet he said, I know you're going to get me better. And lo and behold, he recovered from this meningitis, which everybody thought would kill him, and when asked why, he would say over and over again, well, it's just because I knew you could get me through this, even though the contribution of the particular physician and physicians was relatively minor, except the presence, the very presence of that man, the very sense that he was shepherding his patient through the illness made all the difference. I am a great believer in psychological effects, the effects of the physician's personality, the effects of two or three wrong or right words, one might say, at a crucial time during a patient's hospitalization.
The story you tell, the cardiologist's tale, is an extension of that.
Oh, yes. The cardiologist's tale, it's fascinating to me that the man who told it to me, just to make things clear for your listeners, this is a book with about, more than 20 stories of doctor-patient relationships, and three or four of them are mine, but the others I got by asking some of my most highly regarded colleagues what their most fascinating patient was. And the man who told me the cardiologist story is a world-renowned cardiologist. He's made some very important laboratory and clinical contributions, and yet he treated every one of his patients as if he was their family doctor. And the story is that the patient, who was the curator of the rare book library at our university, had severe heart failure, which year by year got worse and very difficult to treat. Finally, he had a pacemaker put in and a number of other things. A defibrillator was put in. And he reached the point after about 15 years of therapy where there was nothing more to offer. Now, the patient had had a remarkable life dealing with book dealers, with con artists, with all kinds of people that he had to approach and buy books from. And one day, when he was in such severe heart failure that he was having trouble breathing, he came to the physician's office, and rather than let this man lose hope, the physician, the cardiologist, wrote a prescription for him. Right under the RX on the prescription page, he wrote one set of memoirs. He told this man to sit down and write his memoirs, and his spirits perked up immediately. It took about 3 months to do it. He was dictating it with great difficulty to his daughter-in-law during this time, but it gave him some approach to life, some sense of significance and meaning and hope and actually joy in remembering these many experiences he'd had. And then finally, at about 3 months, he came into the physician's office, to the cardiologist's office, with the first photocopy of his memoirs, and right on the front page, which was dedicated to the cardiologist, was that prescription that had been sent to him. And then they decided, since there was nothing they could do, they would turn that defibrillator off, and the patient, almost as though he had willed it, died several hours spontaneously before they turned that machinery off. So here you see a situation where it wasn't drug therapy, it wasn't some brand new modality that had just been invented, it wasn't anything super scientific. It was just that this cardiologist so understood and so wanted to understand the patient's emotional life, past life, that he was able to provide this last gift toward the end of life.
The fact that we've learned more about the psychological component in this mind-body connection, what impact has that had on doctors who oftentimes have looked at the clinical environment as a scientific environment alone, and certainly in the past not taken this into account in the same way?
Well, it's unfortunate that a great deal of the work on emotions on the immune system, let's say, whether you have more ability to fight off disease or whether you're more prone to a particular disease, is in rather difficult to understand psychiatric literature. A psychologist friend who does research in this area sent me one of his papers recently, and he reviewed the whole literature on different personality types and the diseases they're likely to get. And I have to tell you that the likelihood of any internist or surgeon reading that material is very small. You'd have a difficult time searching through the regular medical literature, the New England Journal of Medicine, the American Journal of Medicine, the American Journal of Surgery, to find these kinds of articles that would alert the average clinical physician or surgeon to the emotional characteristics that often accompany certain kinds of diseases.
You know, we've talked a lot about how patients view doctors today. Talk a little bit about how doctors see their patients, especially patients that come in armed with information from the internet or think that they know better about their own care.
Oh, that's a very difficult situation to deal with, because the very same person who comes in armed with information from the internet is very likely to have a demanding personality. Very likely to try to overrule the doctor from the printed page. And that irks physicians. In the first place, it threatens them. And they feel that they would like to tell this patient off or correct him or something like this. So I think one obviously needs a certain degree of knowledge, but one shouldn't throw it at the physician. One should use it to know what questions to ask. Mark Twain once said that wisdom is the ability to keep your mouth shut when you'd rather be talking. And I think that the knowledge that one can gain from reading in a medical journal or watching what comes up on your screen should be to understand how the physician is functioning and to ask those specific crucial questions that are so important.
To what extent does all the focus, do you think, on medicine today, healthcare, and however this story evolves in the next several years, to what extent is it impacting really the day-to-day lives of doctors?
Well, it hasn't really, except in the sense that more and more doctors are feeling overwhelmed by the problems of treating individual patients. More and more doctors are frustrated by the small amount of time available to see patients, by the fact that they have become so dependent on the CAT scans and the MRIs and who knows what, that they feel like a much smaller cog in the machinery of diagnosis and therapy. Long ago, when we knew less, we would have a physician, we would have one or two consultants, things like this. Now, a patient is lucky to get out of a hospital without having been seen by representatives of four or five or six subspecialty groups, and they often don't put their knowledge together. They often look only at a kidney or a liver or whatever it may be, or a heart. And this leaves the patient actually as frustrated as the doctor, him or herself. So I think the main effect of all the publicization of medicine has been to confuse the relationship between doctor and patient.
And are we seeing more and more young doctors that want to specialize, that don't want to take the holistic approach, but are interested in just the heart or the kidney or whatever?
More and more and more and more, and there are a number of reasons for that. One, unfortunately, and there's no way out of this, is the economic reason, that one can earn more in less time being a super specialist than one can as a general internist. General internists are rewarded by the insurance companies in a lesser way than doctors who are highly specific and can join a practice group that's also highly specific. So what we're seeing is people who in the old days might have wanted to become general internists finding that it's too much of a sacrifice. And, of course, that's one of the reasons that the old family physician is gone. There are residencies in family practice, but, of course, as you know from reading the newspapers, they go begging as compared to residencies in nephrology, diseases of the kidney, or cardiac diseases, or something of this nature.
Are there common threads, have you, over all of your years of dealing with young doctors, would-be doctors, are there common threads among those young people that want to be doctors?
Well, there's one common thread, but it's being less and less acted out. What happens is that the young people who come to us for medical training always feel a closeness with other human beings that makes them want to combine their biological or medical knowledge with knowledge of humanity. The trouble is, 4 years later, they come out of medical school and they're so overwhelmed by the technology that we teach them that the humanistic aspect that originally drew them to this profession is less. And then we put them into a period of training. For surgeons, it could be 7 or 8 years. Usually it's about, let's say, 3 or 4 years. And we cone them down more and more specifically to think about the mechanics of the body and the mechanics of the equipment that we use to treat that body. So willy-nilly, wanting to or not, our educational system erases to a certain extent the humanity that made these young people be drawn to a medical career in the first place.
Dr. Sherwin Newland, the book is The Soul of Medicine, Tales from the Bedside. Sherwin, I thank you so much for spending time with us.